any competition for scarce resources leads to oligarchy. Why? Because it's a game, and every iteration of the game, somebody is more lucky or more clever than you. So they already have more resources for the second game and then the third game. And so whether it's land or money, you see it, you know, that is always this tendency towards oligarchy.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle, for joining me. You don't quite know it, but your ideas and the Peer-to-Peer Foundation Wiki was very transformative in my thinking. I think I came across it around sort of 2006, 2007, when I was looking at the Pirate Party.
That was right at the beginning.
Yeah. I was very much in the sort of like file sharing side of peer-to-peer networks. But coming across the Peer-to-Peer Foundation and what they were doing with the Pirate Party, I kind of started realizing the broader scope of peer-to-peer technologies, peer production, and the notion of a public good and building these as these protocols and these networks as public goods is something that's stayed with me since, and I've been trying to kind of build that out. So that's like one reason. Also, another reason I'd like to speak with you is, you know, you've talked about the network society. You've been very concerned with civilizational transitions, as I understand it, and I'm very much about this notion of cyber states and so on. So yeah, I guess before we get into any of that, would you like to introduce yourself?
All right. So my name is obviously Michel Bouwens. I'm from Belgium originally. I would say, unfortunately, I'm 66. Starts to count. And I live in northern Thailand, in Chiang Mai, which last week was the most polluted city in the world, but which I nevertheless recommend outside of these hazing months, which is, you know, like March to May. It's quite a wonderful place to live normally. And it's, you know, one of the places where the number of digital nomads is very, very high. And used to be Westerners, now it's like a lot of Chinese people are coming here. So, you know, the last few meetings of digital nomads that I attended were like full of Asian people from India, from Pakistan, from everywhere. So, it's, you know, you kind of feel the shift also in the zeitgeist and in the vibe, you know, de-Westernization is in the air. What else did I say? Yeah, so I founded the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. That was I took a two-year sabbatical in 2002, 2003, which was, the purpose was to study transitions. And I came to the conclusion that before you have, you know, really radical transformations like revolutions and stuff, that this is really only the last stage, and it only happens when society cannot adapt peacefully, then, you know, you need something more violent to shake its foundations. But that mostly what's of importance is seed forms. So, you know, the way you should imagine it, and I know this is already outside of self-presentation, the way you should imagine it, so you have a relatively stable system, you know, that has solved some basic societal issue and that has a set of institutions that, as it has solved its institutions, creates its own problems, as it were, which can no longer be solved with that solution. And so at that point, people start quitting, either voluntarily because they have like an anticipatory consciousness, or because they have to, because the old system no longer provides what they need and expect. And so these seed forms are experimentations in a new logic, which eventually will find each other, create subsystems, and eventually be strong enough to, you know, to transform the whole civilization. So that's the way I look at the world. And so, of course, right now, I look at the world at around two specific things, which is peer-to-peer, which is the capacity for translocal self-organization. So that's, you know, you have peer-to-peer in a tribal environment with, you know, a small village, and people can solve their issues by talking to their family members mostly, because that's what tribes were about kinship. I'm talking about, you know, what we are doing here. And all the systems that go with it. So the fact that people can join ecosystems of collaboration which transcend pure geography. And, you know, that's not to say that's the only reality, but that is certainly to say that this will change the old reality, and that I think this is civilizational because civilization was actually a relation between agriculture and the city. So it's the surplus of agriculture allows you to create a new class, a writing class, and, you know, which was a minority, and the writing class created markets and states, you know, to kind of upscale from tribal arrangements. And I think we're reaching a new pivot. So I think this is actually more like a 5,000-year shift rather than just like, you know, a 50-year shift or even a 500-year shift. I think we are moving towards this new form of mutual coordination. So distributed coordination by peers. But to do that, they need commons. So this is the second concept. So the second concept is commons, which is shared resources that are managed or created or defended by a community or a group of stakeholders using their own regulation. And so that immediately distinguishes from the market and the state. So, you know, without saying or expecting that they will disappear anytime soon, I do think that we are creating this new sphere. So I don't know if you know Mark Stallman from the Center for the Study of Digital Life. He has a good way to, he says you have East and West, and now you have digital. So you have this kind of like, you know, market-centric versus state-centric competition between the West and the Russia-China axis and the BRICS, on, you know, mostly allied now with them. So that's like the struggle in the geosphere. But then we have a new layer, and we come with our own solutions. And then, of course, there's a big debate, and maybe we can have that debate, whether the, you know, purely libertarian solution is the solution, or whether, you know, it's something else, or some kind of hybrid adaptation between, you know, the earlier layer, physical layer, and this new layer. So that's the whole debate, I think, that is of interest, is like, you know, where are we going? And so if you study civilization, I will stop, I promise, you know, and especially civilization transition of the past, I think this gives you a lot of patterns that, you know, without saying they will be repeated in the same way, you it still, you know, allows you to think like, what if, right? What if this pattern, you know, is now also operative in this transition? And how would it be different once we have the digital? So that's the kind of what I used to do my thinking. I look at the end of Rome and, you know, like medieval, I love medieval society, Western medieval society. I think it's a very good image of a distributed system. You know, it was contracts, not digital contracts, but it was contract-based society, very local, but at the same time, a unified culture through the monks and the Catholic Church. And again, I'm not saying this to say we're going towards the same, but I think it's very useful to study patterns of the past and see if they apply or not, and whether they are transformed or not, and how they are transformed. And whether there's new things that, you know, that didn't exist before, but it helps you see the present, especially, you know, because we are in a presentist moment, right, where people can't see anything, like it's chaos. So, you know, and they can't project themselves. That's very dangerous, right?
Definitely.
If you cannot project yourself, and, you know, and there's basically two ways to deal with that. One is transcendence. You know, you become spiritual. And you choose a vertical dimension and you kind of like move away from the world in a certain way. Or you can have a horizontal transcendence, which is like to have a long enough view that you can project yourself beyond the catastrophe, which, you know, every civilization transition also is. So, and that can give you strength and hope. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with, you know, my narratives about peer-to-peer and the commons.
Right. Nice. I mean, thank you for that. There's a lot to unpack and I'd love to get into. So I guess like when it comes to this sort of like 5,000 year shift, where are we in that sort of period, I guess, in your mind? Like if we bring this to like a more concrete, like I assume that you think we're undergoing this civilizational shift. And then like, what is the agriculture equivalent we're talking about here? Is this the net or how, or, you know, just instantaneous communication?
Let me say a bit about cycles maybe first. So what I believe is that we are in a concatenation of cycles. I hope that's a good English word. What I mean is that a lot of cycles which are in the descending phase are, you know, coming together and making the crisis very intense. So we have a Kondratiev cycle. This is the cycle of the political economy, which is about 50 years, you know, has a upswing peak and downswing and then a sudden systemic crisis. This is rather easy, I think, to pinpoint because, so started in 45, you know, we had an upswing. The middle was 73, you know, we had the oil crisis and everything. And I think definitely 2008 was the end of it, was when the whole, you know, that system kind of crashed. There is a 100-year cycle.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but like when we're talking about these cycles, are you talking about it in like a sort of Spengler, Toynbee, Burnham kind of sense?
But they have long, I'll come to it. They have long cycles. I'm starting with the small ones and I get to the longer ones. The short is on average 50 years, but you know, when you say 50, it can be 60 or 40, and it's
some
like
standard deviation. Like,
it's a political economy system. So, and you can, you know, we had two phases before the peak, the welfare state, and then after the peak, the neoliberal system. And then that crashed in 2008. So there we are in the chaotic transition of the political economy cycle and seeking a new combination of energy and, you know, work organization and all of that. But then there is the 100-year cycle, which is described in the fourth generation book, right, where you have a first generation after the crisis, rebuild society. 25 years, one generation. The second generation, 68, starts revolting against the system already. The third phase is when they're both on the same level of strength. So the old and the new are like in the 90s. And then the fourth generation cycle is when you enter chaos. And so that's a civic cycle. It pertains to civic institutions like the trust in democracy. We can clearly see, you know, it's largely gone. People don't trust the press, don't trust the media. That's not an economic issue. That's a civic issue. Like, how do we organize ourselves politically? And of course, they're related. Yeah. But
shreds remain of that generative AI is going to completely ruin as well.
So then you have, you know, you can see that the war cycle and the hegemony cycle are also 100 years, are related to that second cycle. And what happens is every 100 years there's a big war. Think Napoleon, World War One, World War Two, and now you can feel it. We're going back to a very unstable period with Ukraine, Gaza. And this is just, you know, in the last 2 years. And who knows, you know, Iran could get involved and the Houthis and, you know, and China and Taiwan. I mean, it's not, you know, it's getting very unstable, right? And so hegemonic means like a change of hegemon, right? The Portuguese, the Dutch, the British, they had actually two cycles and the American cycle. And I think it's very likely that the American hegemony is, you know, is going down, which is very dangerous because, you know, it's like a wounded tiger, you know, if you're that's when you're most
crashing in its last throes. Right. Yeah.
Right. So then so now Toynbee and Spengler, they are about long cycles and it's 1,000 year and 500 years. So basically you could have this kind of idea that, you know, so you have chaos, out of that comes a civilization, eventually creates cities and they're decentralized, right? Eventually they start fighting to each other and creating alliances against each other. And eventually they exhausted themselves. So that's what happened to Greece, I think around the 4th century BC. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to Italy in the 14th century, right? So when you reach that 500-year stage of a civilization, the second phase is a centralizing phase of civilization. Now, in Europe, because England was always destroying the would-be empires, we have a very special system, which is the nation state. So we never got a true empire, but nation states are also centralizing, you know, agents, right? They centralize in a smaller area, but then they unite in an international system, and which was clearly dominated by the U.S. since, you know, the 1940s. So I would say we are also at the end of a 1,000-year cycle of Western civilization, because that started more or less in 998 with the German Holy Roman Empire, you know, which restored a kind of integrative dynamic, because between 500 and 1,000 is chaos. It's a dark age. So it's only when the Holy Roman Empire establishes itself that you get, you know, like the growth of the High Middle Ages, and so that 500 period collapses in 1500. It's a longer process, but that basically creates the conditions for the nation state system, which again, you know, has different iterations, and I think that is ending now, right?
Absolutely. So
that's 500 and 1,000 year, and then the 5,000 year is the idea that civilization was an agrarian, a rural urban relationship. And, you know, which can also then go into complications, but let's stay simple, that we now have this new layer, the translocal layer of self-organized translocal communities, right? And then if you don't mind, I can historicize that a little bit. So I think 93 is a key date because we democratized the digital. Before 93, it's used by companies, big governments, but citizens have no access to it. So in 93 is like the explosion after the web and the browser, right? Then open source, and I'm not sure what date to put on open source, but open source, why is this important? It's the first time we can coordinate human labor at a global scale outside of corporations and states. So, you know, small groups of on average 5 people can create a coalition of 25,000 workers with 500 companies involved and create Linux.
Yeah.
Right?
So and run on billions of devices and the backbone of...
Exactly, yeah. So, and the market and state cannot even do that on their own. So without the open source commons, no state or company is actually able to do it by themselves. And, okay, then crypto comes in, which is the second layer. Because I think the problem with open source was that we couldn't fund the core of the commons.
Yeah.
So the people interfacing with the market, you know, could get money for certification, education, improving, adaptation. But the people working for the core had to be subsidized by big multinationals. Mm-hmm. And so the problem of open source is it's under heavy influence of big companies that, you know, that are very influential in the core of these open source developments. And so crypto is interesting because it allows for the financing of that open source work in the core. And so now you see Ethereum, you know, funding public goods. So taxing itself, as it were, right? Optimism, you pay double the cost of maintaining and growing I don't know how you call it, like a chain or whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
And they give it to Gitcoin. And Gitcoin then funds the commons of Ethereum, right? So this is extraordinarily significant because we have the capacity now from within the network to finance your own commons. Now, I think there's still, you know, a big problem, and which I will explain right now, which is the relationship. I still think crypto is incomplete because it doesn't deal with real production, right? So when you look at declining civilizations, let me give you very quickly the end of Rome. So Rome is a slave-based system, right? You conquer, you get slaves and booty and gold, and then you pay the soldiers with that booty. When you can no longer conquer, now you have to start paying your soldiers. So you have to start taxing, right? And then the landlords have to pay the tax. But as the system declines, you know, the people leave the cities and look for to go back to the countryside to be closer to food production. And they start, you know, putting pressure on the landlords to pay them, you know, to lower the rents. So then the Roman state says, we're going to make them colony, force them to stay on the land so that the landlords can pay their taxes. So that's the beginning of feudalism already within the, right, as a root within the Roman Empire, right? So what I'm saying is, and so what you also have to understand is that at the end of the Roman Empire, there was no more money. Like literally, right, the monetary system collapsed. So you go back to food, you know, so I'm a farmer, you're the landlord. I give you, you know, half of my food production. And so you can pay soldiers that will protect me. That's, right, that's the social contract feudalism. Yeah. And so what I'm, so my critique of crypto is that if you just think that you can do like an exodus of the old system and then do an arbitrage between nation states, you know, and oh, if Portugal collapses, we go to Greece. If Greece collapses, we go to the Canary Islands. You know, right, at some point it will bite you in the ass because
you're not producing.
We don't want these parasites. You know, we don't want these parasites. And so I think crypto should get involved in physical production, in reorganizing physical production, in creating what I call mutual coordination economics with your own supply chains. Okay, this is another topic. I can go into it, but okay, I have so many questions,
and like there's a bunch of things that I want to unpack. This is great stuff. Are you familiar with Bertrand de Jouvenel, who did the book on power?
Yeah, I read it. Yeah, very interesting.
Because one of my questions is, and it certainly comes up, you know, after the fall of Rome, in his examples, you know, basically how things start to re-centralize. I don't know if you have any ideas around like why that has, or if you agree with some of his ideas.
Okay,
or...
so let me explain Spengler because he sheds light on this. So a civilization is a mixture at first. Mm-hmm. You have an invader and a local population. And that's why you have to go beyond custom because both have their own customs. And now they're together, they have to reinvent society in order to live together, right? And so essentially you have a warrior class, which is the invading class, and a priestly class, which tries to civilize the warriors. Because, you know, you need almost psychopaths to go to war. But then, of course, when they come home, they do the same and they rape the women. And so you know, to have a civilization, you need both. You need the warriors and the priests. And the priests are there to soften you know, the
like a regulating function
of the warriors, right? So eventually, you know, they're successful, they create a surplus, and you get cities. So the cities create a third class, which is the merchant class and the guilds and stuff, right? So this is where you get the Jouvenel, because what he notices is that, and this is not like Marx, who only sees two, you know, dialectics, and Jouvenel sees trialectics, right? He sees bottom, middle, and top. And so what Jouvenel says is that the top will mobilize the bottom against the middle, right?
Right.
So the cities and the kings will ally against the aristocracy and inevitably will actually abolish the caste system eventually. And it happens in every civilization, not just in the West. Byzantium, China, you know, Spengler really documents that this is a very universal pattern, right? So then in the cities, as they grow bigger and bigger, you create a fourth class, he says, which is the working class, and they want democracy, and they'll get democracy, but democracy is corrupted by money, and eventually that will collapse as well. And then you get what he calls Caesarism.
Mm.
And I think there's very good grounds to say that we are now entering a Caesarist period.
Right. You know,
figures like Trump. Yeah. So, you know, if you talk to people who like Trump, it's not that they like everything he is or does, but they say, we need a crazy guy like that just to, you know, be a bull in the China shop, because otherwise nothing is going to change for us, right? And because the system is so stuck, you know, so you get these figures coming out and they do the arbitrage between the people, right? So what a Caesar can do is say, "Oh, I'll give this to the working class, and I'll give this to the capitalists, and I'll give this to the church," and because they are in a how do you say this in English? Like a pat situation where nobody can win, right? The Reds and the Blues in the US, they can't win. It's a stalemate. So then you can have a figure coming out who can decide who to favor. And if this side comes too strong, he'll support for a while the other side, right? So that's what a Caesar usually does, is somebody who allies with the poor, you know, and then changes the system and gives enough to the poor so that they're happy with him. Yeah. You know, Perón, Napoleon, they are figures like that. And I think Trump is probably has the potential to be a figure like that.
Gotcha. Thanks for that. I guess so one of the things that, you know, we talked about crypto and how this improves the open source dynamics, you know, and building these sort of public goods. But like in the light of this, I've kind of been a little bit concerned in the way that I've been viewing, blockchain networks, because I'm starting to view them more like social orders and the consensus algorithm much more like a form of popular sovereignty in a way. And I can imagine this order being the backbone or basis for a, cyber state, virtual state, temporary autonomous zone, network state, whatever you want to call it. And so then like when we start talking about, funding of these public goods, it's almost like a developmental state in that it is investing heavily in infrastructure. But that patronage is also kind of a centralizing force because it creates this strong dependency. So unless, we build out token economics and mechanisms for these various public goods to be self-sustaining, I could see, maybe in, I don't know which cycle it would be, 50 or 100 years time, that, a crypto SAR comes up and
I think you should actually see it that way in a way, right? Because we can't be fully utopian. So because nature, is cyclic and human culture is cyclic. And so here's my view. So any competition for scarce resources leads to oligarchy.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's a game, and every iteration of the game, somebody's more lucky or more clever than you. So they already have more resources for the second game and then the third game. And so whether it's land or money, you see it, that is always this tendency towards oligarchy. Mm-hmm. Unless you either react to it violently. So that's actually, few people know that, but Greek democracy was a revolution against the landed aristocracy, which was, lending out money at high interest. And that's what created Greek democracy as a revolt against, the self-enslaving by the landlords. And then the way to maintain it is by having anti-oligarchic measures, right? And so again, I'm happy to see I think quadratic funding and quadratic voting, I'm not very technical and I'm not sure exactly how they work, but I think, they seem to me to be anti-oligarchic efforts, right? To balance contribution with the, let's say, the investor tokens and give more power to people who contribute to the network itself. So I think to the degree that we can find these like balancing measures, we can maintain, the systems longer. Will it be forever? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't expect it, because in the past we haven't been able to do it either. Look at like medieval cities. They were self-organized, run by the guilds. And only later, did the merchant guilds dominate. And then out of the merchant guilds came these families that started dominating the whole city, like the Medici and right? It took a while, but there's a long period where, maybe 150 years, half a 300-year cycle where we had very democratic run cities. 98% of the people in the Middle Ages were member of associations, fraternities, with their own judiciary and everything. I hope you can see that, there's some perils there with the way the crypto world is developing, right? Except that they're not territorial.
DAOs are kind of like guilds,
Yeah, and you actually have now, you know, they call themselves guilds, like a protocol guild and stuff. So this kind of tendency towards distribution and decentralization, which you see in crypto, is kind of creating similar phenomena than, you know, when we were creating these decentralized city systems. But again, you know, we'll have to see whether we can go out of the cycle or not. To some degree, I think this is the real challenge, actually. Okay, and here I have to be optimistic. So I'll give you a big scheme. I like schemes. So here's another one. So nature created, or God, if you like, you know, created an immature biosphere, right? And then you have something called the Great Oxygenation Event, which was poisonous, but then actually created a mature biosphere eventually. So you know, based on oxygen, and what, you know, what some people call Gaia, but it's scientific now. It's called Earth System Science, which is, you know, it's actually a system that tries to maintain itself. It's mysterious, you know, but they have identified many feedback systems that recreate order when there is chaos and disorder, right? So then we come. So nature creates culture, right? So humanity creates a new layer. So you have the geosphere, the biosphere of life, and then the noosphere of human culture. And what we create is an immature technosphere, right? Which is eating the biosphere and eating the geosphere in an unsustainable way. So the big challenge for me is, can we move from an immature technosphere to a mature technosphere, right? And I think this is the big challenge. This is the big transition. And if we succeed in that, then maybe we can live for thousands of years in balance with the planet. I think that's the great hope, right? And so where does crypto come in? I think crypto creates a planetary scale mutual coordination economy, but I call it cosmolocal, because why do we need to be local? Because 2/3 of the expenditure of matter and energy is actually transporting now. And that's way too much. Like, you know, there's very good butter in Patagonia, but they're getting bankrupt by the New Zealand butter. Right?
Right.
there's no need for absurd. That. Like, yeah. That's absurd, right? Or you think about shrimp, you know, they're fished in New England, they're sent to China, and then they come back. Same thing here, you know, the apples go to China and then they come back. So there is a lot, enormous waste, because we are fixated on money, and money doesn't give us the right signals about thermodynamic realities, right? And so there's a lot of things in crypto that are potential solutions to this. So the first thing is the actual ability to coordinate production on a global scale. So we relocalize, we mutualize certain things because it's cheap to do certain things collectively. But then we have the layer of the noosphere, which is cosmic, right? What is heavy is local, and what is light is global. And so I always say to the localist that localism is sublinear. You lose efficiency if you're only local.
Mm-hmm.
But cosmolocal is superlinear. We gain efficiency by combining the local with the cosmic. Right, so relocalized production, but global cooperation. And so you ask me how long, you know, the crisis can last. So one of the answers is this: it used to take 4 generations. I don't think we have 4 generations. So our hope is the acceleration of technology, and that's where AI comes in. You know, for me, not as some mystical intelligence is going to take over, but as something that is going to be like a tool that is going to tell us the limits of what we can spend for humanity, right? So I see a first layer of stigmergic coordination. So because of open source and crypto, we can see the whole ecosystem. So we move from a situation where you have competing states and markets which can only see their own thing. Am I making more profit? Am I getting enough taxes? they never see the impact, the externalities. Now we have a universal ledger, the blockchain, where, you know, and so this is a fourth layer. You have markets, states, nonprofits. We're creating an integrative meta layer of coordination of those three sectors, plus all the free contributors that can also join a collaborative ecosystem. And it's cosmo-local. It works both for the local and for the universal level. So because I think we need it. So we need planetary without having a world government. And I think that's
where commons-based
networks are that, are the equivalent of a world government based on states.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I've come to some similar conclusions and parallels, but from a slightly different angle. And you know, more from a technical way, and like how you can retain these sort of utilities and properties of, you know, what we love about Bitcoin and Ethereum. One example in terms of the US's, you know, potential decline, and its position as being, you know, effectively the de facto peacekeeper for the planet, and consequently the US dollar being essentially the world reserve currency, right? But through its overuse of economic sanctions, you're finding BRICS countries are now starting to create alternate swap lines to circumvent the US dollar effectively.
Right.
And within that, there's a call for the notion of political neutrality in a world reserve currency. Like this would be a highly desired property.
Which the West, right? Unfortunately, is, you know, that makes me angry that, you know, they freeze Russian assets, right? You're telling the world you cannot trust the Western financial system.
Yeah.
When you are bombing, exactly. The Nord Stream, you're telling the world, oh, it's okay to destroy physical infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, the West have set very bad precedents.
Absolutely.
You know, which I think comes from the panic of the US of losing its hegemony, and you know, it's willing to do everything to keep it, but it's in many ways counterproductive.
I agree. So, like, with this idea in mind, and I was also reading, I think it's called, is the International Legal Order Unraveling, which is done by, I want to say, the American Law Institute. I could be wrong on the publisher on that and the title.
They can note that.
It is a set of American lawyers who work in international law, and they start, you know, looking at all the different aspects of, how world order has changed certainly post World War II. But what these sort of vertical and horizontal rules and how they're being treated. And so, like, if you view blockchain is as politically neutral as possible, and in my view, you know, this includes, network level privacy as well as private transactions, are almost necessary to maintain that. If you have that in place, then it actually becomes like a great order for, you know, this global coordination. And then the stakeholders or the participants in the consensus algorithm can be state and global non-state actors, yet they retain their sovereignty because they can either, withdraw from the usage of that order or fork it, right?
So that's a very good example of, you know, fourth sector, right? Where you were creating this meta-integration. And I think that's the most realistic because, you know, when you talk about network states and network nations, I mean, definitely there is something going on. I'm not denying that people are self-organizing and wanting to do this and, you know, assembling money and that, you know, like at this stage, you know, which is like the network city stage, you can imagine some countries like Morocco or Tunisia and saying, oh, why don't you come here? You know, and that attracts money and knowledge. I mean, that I think can certainly happen. But, you know, given
that's a digital nomad version of it almost. Yeah.
Right? Given the scale of China and Russia, I think we shouldn't rush into like utopianism about it. You know,
No.
So it's going to be like a play of mutual adaptation for a certain time where, and so I think this strategy is the best one where, You know, so the difference is the following. So market societies in the West competing with state-centric societies, you know, in the East Eurasian side, and then the BRICS with them, they want to. So the state is becoming stronger in Russia and China, not weaker, sure. right? So you have to be careful to be realistic about what is happening in the world.
So this is what I wanted to get back to around this East versus West versus digital, right? So like the main issue that I see with that trichotomy is that the digital is basically dependent on the East and West's physical infrastructure, right? And so... that's a huge dependency. So again, this is why I think, you know, blinding the network level traffic between peers may be a way that you can reach netizens in countries that may not be able to access it under normal conditions. So then,
as a relatively autonomous actor, you know, these proto network nations. Mm-hmm. I like the word coordinations that was invented by, you know, Primavera de Filippi and her crew. I think that's a really nice word, coordinations, because it leaves it open to what exactly it's going to be, you know, how, you know, but they have a vested interest to protect themselves, right? And so this, I think, is inevitable, right? You as a kind of, so... Okay, I'm not sure if this is a good analogy, but I like it. So 5,000 years ago, we create writing. Mm-hmm. That creates a writing class, and they create a world to their image through markets and states. You know, we can do their accounting and their writing. And okay, then today we have a new language, coding, and a coding class, right, which has access to its computers. So that's their means of production. But they don't have access to the means of valuation, the networks that would, because they are still controlled by corporations and states. And so naturally, if they want to create a world to their image, they're pushed to create, you know, their own infrastructures and to do arbitrage and to protect themselves. And I think this is where crypto, you know, is very important. To create all these things, because of course, you know, I don't know what you think about this, but I think that in the West we're moving pretty fast to a Chinese situation in the sense of, you know, surveillance, control, and you know, I actually tend to believe that there's this woman, what's her name, Catherine Austin Fitz, and she says, okay, today the war, so you have a declining system, it loses legitimacy. So you have a fragmentation because the integrating narrative loses legitimacy, right? So you have fragmentation. Fragmentation creates polarization, because if you're alone, you're looking like, where can I find the most support, right? So this creates the pagans against the Christians, the Reformation against the Catholic Church, and I think today the culture war. And I think the culture war today is... two factions in the ruling class, and this is where du Juvenel comes in. You know, it's always about alliances, jurisdictional alliances. So these factions are trying to get more strength by looking who can support us in the people, right? And, you know, the middle class, upper middle class, working class, rural. So they're trying to strengthen their coalitions. And so you have one coalition which wants to sacrifice the nation to the empire. You know, the globalists, as the right wing would say, and I think that's real. And you know, like the West,
I think it's an accurate assessment.
Is the West one? Their ideal is a world run by multi-stakeholder coalitions in domains, global domains, but dominated by financial capital. You know, the Black Rocks of our world,
and then managed democracy. The other side, you know,
yes, you know, the other side is sacrificing the empire to the nation. So these are this is Trump, you know, allied to local business people, to the rural, to those who want to bring back industry and things to America, but they don't think they can continue to fund 800 bases abroad.
Yeah, and, I think like and, the
and I sorry, and I don't want to choose either side. I think either, you know, they both have strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
So I think that the commoners, this is how I think about it, is that the commoners, so the people who are self-creating these productive ecosystems that are partially translocal, you know, we should first of all strengthen our own power.
Yeah.
And then look at who's supporting our agenda. That's the way I think about it. So to not necessarily to choose sides, although I want to choose a side that gives me the maximum amount of freedom of speech and pluralism, you know, and
sure.
I'm not sure what side is the best for that. I actually, you know, increasingly tend to believe that the side that's in power now is doing the worst in terms of suppressing free speech.
Yeah, I think like you know, some of the populist movements we're seeing, or you know, maybe nationalist movements, this sort of sacrificing the empire for the nation. I think they have a lot of really important points for understanding or criticizing the current status of our empire, right, or of our civilization. But at least how I see it, it's almost this kind of this return to the single nation with, you know, a standard territory. I don't think is actually viable.
Also reactionary, right? Yes.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very reaction.
It's not a future. It's not a future. It's a way to react. Yeah, I agree with that.
So I think, you know, for that to be viable, there almost needs to be like some kind of transnational policy network between those nations and to basically create a counterbalance to a globalist. So the point being is like the stage is at the global level, you know, for this iteration. And we'll probably, depending on the timeline, it'll probably dictate how the world governs itself, right? And I don't know, maybe we'll get some kind of, you know, quasi-utopian Star Trek military, you know, government controlling the world, or I don't know what it's going to look like.
Yeah, so but I guess that's exciting. Kind of... And of course, you know what they say in Chinese, may you live in interesting times, which apparently is a curse.
We certainly do.
And so, you know, we're going to have a lot of swings. I think we have to expect wild swings in politics, you know, where, you know, if you look, for example, at Republicans in the U.S. and what they want to do if they win power, some of it is frightening, you know, like closing the DEA. Closing DEI, I can live with that personally, but closing the DEA, maybe, you know. So, you know, kicking out 50,000 people, you know, on the first day he comes in office, you know, I'm not saying I'm necessarily against it, but it's, you know, these are like destabilizing. If they do it, yeah. It's going to be very destabilizing. It's going to create massive resistance. You know, look at what's happening in Argentina. And, you know, with serious dangers of civil war in some countries, and especially I think the U.S.
Civil war would be on the
table. I'm not predicting it's going to happen, but I certainly think that the danger is there. And there are some of these scientific, institutes. I forgot the name, but there's one in Scandinavia, and, you know, they're based on what happened in Bosnia and Yugoslavia. And so they have quite objective criteria. And they say, like, U.S. is 70%,
right?
Which is... You know, wow. It's not 100%, but it's 70% of all the criteria which conditions the eventual outbreak. And this is where, you know, Europe now is not in a good shape. I think it's being vassalized by the U.S. and doing things that are counter to its own interests. Which, by the way, is also typical for the end of an empire. So as you lose control of the far abroad, you come back to your near abroad, right? And then you have to hyper exploit your near allies in order to resist. So Europe is in a bad shape, but Europe has a interconnected network of 400 cities with long history, still integrated in their territorial regions. And that are very well connected to each other. So we kind of primed for distributed. So if, you know, if the EU or the nation states collapse, we have this kind of underlying, and you see the map of the Holy Roman Empire. It's very colored. It has like, you know, 80 different regions in Germany. and yet they all chose an emperor, and that lasts for 1,000 years. So that was like a, you know, a very stable, relatively distributed system. The U.S. has 40 cities, which are not well connected, except by plane. So the U.S. is primed for regional breakup.
Interesting.
And so that's a, maybe a good side of Europe, is that we have all these, you know, old historical cities where, you know, convivially built, architecturally built, you know, they're very pleasant, you know, to live in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I try to spend as much time in Europe as I can.
I'm still a bit patriotic. You know, I think it's still, you know, we have things that are likable.
No. Yeah, nice. I guess, like, you know, so going back to these sort of like seed forms, you know, we've talked about, you know, the crypto as being a potential seed form and an evolution of open source technologies and, you know, creating these public goods. Is there any other seed forms that you identify at the moment?
Well, the two for me are peer-to-peer and the commons, and they reiterate everywhere. Like, you know, so that's basically what my wiki is about. You know, I have 25,000 articles per domain, business, spirituality, and you will see that everywhere the same thing is happening. These seed forms are emerging, but those are like the two common points.
So that's
why I say peer-to-peer networks based on commons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you need a common infrastructure for collective action. If you have only individual, then nobody wants to invest in the things that we all need to do together to be stronger together. So that's why you need commons, right? And that's why we needed states in geography, because otherwise, you know, privately, why would I buy, you know, invest in a road?
Yeah.
You know, that I'm using only once.
The private market tends to, you know.
Right. So the collective action
look
problem,
at short-term gains.
Right. Which was solved by the state as a collective actor.
Right. No, that's interesting. And, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. You know, and so at the network level, we also need to solve the collective action problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the commons and not the state.
Yeah. I can
you
see
know,
that.
We have parastates, right? So you look at open source communities, they do have these for benefit associations like the Wikimedia mm-hmm. Foundation and the Drupal Fund Association, and, you know, which acts as a collective entity, you know, to broker agreements between multiple stakeholders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And crypto, for some reason, is trying to avoid human deliberation and go, you know, to a kind of incentive-based consensus. And, you know, I still am not sure if that's going to work fully, but I think where it makes sense is that, you know, it's the evolution of trust, right? So you have big, little sister, little brother, tribal.
Mm-hmm.
You can always go to some family member. Everybody's your aunt and your uncle, and everybody loves you. And, you know, you go, you solve problems through talking together, and maybe the elders, you know, you have to go in front of the elders. Then we scaled up to empires, right? Mm-hmm. So then you get Big Father. But why are we working together over long distance? Because we fear the same God and the punishment by the priests, right?
Yes.
Then we move to the nation state, Big Brother, because we're all equal citizens and the state is our Big Brother. Mm-hmm. I think somewhat controversially, we're now in Big Mother, which is, you know, so because we are feminizing and 70% of the universities are led by women. And so it's, you know, it's for your safety, right? We're going to protect you. So it's like benevolent surveillance.
It's almost like there's now a maternalism, and
this is like a gender difference, you know, like this has been studied, like 70% of the men would say, we want truth.
Right.
And 70% of the women would say, we want safety. We want to protect the weak. So there's, you know, there's outliers in both groups, but like there's this general thing of value differentiation, right? And so that's why we now have censorship in the name of the good, right? Like you can't critique minorities but it's very, you know, very repressive, I think. Like, you know, this, like,
Yeah, like the intentions are good, right? But the mechanisms and used to employ it.
You know, it's a protective intention.
But the mechanism, is...
Yeah, and so I think we need to go back to little brother, little sister, but on a distributed network, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. And create smaller communities that can decide autonomously in their... So it's going from tribalism to neo-tribalism, not kinship-based, but affinity-based.
Definitely.
Right? And if you think about it integrally... You know, like Ken Wilber stuff, right? You might be familiar with that. So the idea of transcend and include, right? So we have tribal, then we have these empires. We have the eggshell revolution, which creates like communitarian systems like, you know, Judaism and Buddhism and Christianity. Then we have the capitalist, you know, entrepreneurial layer, modernity, science, technology, postmodern layer, which is like, you know, we should be critical about our own and like see through our own determinations and, you know, anyway. And I think we need to kind of like, you know, take things from every system, right? In a new kind of integrative framework, a meta integrative idea. And so, you know, I work with Daniel Schmachtenberger and his team. With people like Zachary Stein, I'm contracted to the Civilization Research Institute, and you know we talk about the meta crisis there, right? Which is the idea that so the poly crisis is we have multiple crises and they're all related, and you can't solve one problem without the others. The meta crisis is one step further: is we are looking to generative common patterns that are seen in all these crises, and so if we can work on these patterns, then we can solve all the crises at the same time. So I'm not sure if they're going to succeed, but that's kind of the aim. And then what I'm doing, you know, in that project, because that is not my specialty, is confronting this kind of systems theory, cybernetics theory, with civilizational history, right? Because the problem with systems theory is that you have agents in a network. There's no subjectivity. There's no culture. There's no history. And I think for human beings, that is actually very important. So, you know, like...
I've come to the same conclusion. We're trying
to merge, you know, these two approaches in something that is like a... You know, I'm not saying we're going to succeed, but that's what we're trying to do. And then the other thing I might want to say... Go ahead. No, go ahead. I just want to say I have another project that you might want to know about.
Ahead. I mean, so on that... notion of like trust. I think for me, when I got into crypto, one of the selling points was this notion of like trustlessness, right? If you're you know, one of the new priests, you can read the code and you understand how everything works. You can trust the mathematics, right? Of course, the average person can't do that, and so like they have to rely on social proof or heuristics to do that. But what that actually was about, I realized later, was the erosion of a high trust society that I was embedded in, right? And like that sort of part of the culture was actually what I was looking for, was this this high trust society that I used to be part of as a child and in my youth, I guess.
What was your background? Where were you living?
In Australia. Yeah. So, but I've been traveling. I've been, digital nomad for probably the past sort of 17 or 18 years now. So, did they find any of these before you talk about your next project or the other project you're working on that's interesting? Did they find any meta patterns yet, or are they still, trying to?
No, they have some. I haven't really studied it that much yet. But, like misaligned regulation, social traps. So they use this kind of vocabulary. But, you know, my own project, which is to read all the macro historians, I can tell you it's like so much already that I have a hard time getting other stuff, you know. So I'm really, so there's three phases in macro history. Well, I actually start with Spengler, right? Because he's the first non-Eurocentric macro historian. So in the 19th century, everybody believes in progress, and Europe is the highest stage of progress. And so if everybody copies Europe, then, you know, then we're good, right? And Spain is the first one, even though it was a conservative, to say, no, the West is just one of civilizations. It will also decline eventually. So that was a big shock. And so then you have a whole number of cultural historians, Carol Quigley, Arnold Toynbee, and they react and improve and critique Spengler, but within that cultural framework. With culture, I mean that humans have agency, mm-hmm. that values matter, right? So a civilization for Spengler is like a very particular orientation to the world that is unique mm-hmm. to that civilization. So he will say things like the Greeks, the body in space. So all their right. sculpture is all about the body in space. There's no transcendence right. in the Hellenistic civilization. It's all embodied. For the Christians, it's immediately when it starts, the Gothic cathedral. Infinity. Mm-hmm. For the Byzantians and the Islams, which he actually puts together in some way, even though they're different, it's, you know, it's round, right? It's a protective dome. So right. so that's how he you know, so that's cultural. It's so every civilization has, he calls it a prime symbol. Then you have spiritualist reactions, and that's Aurobindo, the Yad Chardin, Sarkar in India. So these are people who say, no, culture is actually also spiritual. And so they try to kind of like synthesize evolution and modernity with their traditions and their... Okay, so in the 70s, then you have a second layer, which is world system analysis. You know, yeah. and these are basically the neo-Marxist, neo-materialists. So Wallerstein, and they look at geopolitics and, you know, productive systems, and which, you know, is also very interesting. You know, I just see it as a perspective. Huh. And then the last one, which is still going on, is called Big History, mm-hmm. which is the same as what Daniel is doing, which is looking at the patterns of change behind the world of matter, life, and human history. Right? So, for example, right. emergence, bifurcation. You find them in nature, you find them in life, you find them in human culture. So that's so, but you know, it's a big field, right?
Yeah, and a lot of history to go through.
yes.
Yeah. And what was that your? What was the latest project you're working on? You were going to mention?
Oh yeah, no. So this is a story. So I went to for the first time to Suzalu, Montenegro last year in April.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was there for the ZK week. Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, I was quite critical about crypto and everything. I had my resistance, let's see. But I sat on a table, you know, and there was a climate denialist. So somebody who doesn't believe in climate change. There was an impact investor, so that some people would call a greenwasher. And there was a deep adaptationist, you know, collapses. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they could talk together peacefully on one table,
yeah.
you know, which is almost impossible now on social media and even elsewhere. Because why? They had a commons. The commons, they are building this infrastructure that will be good for all of them together, right? And so they can put their difference between brackets and focus on their commonality. And so that is the power of the commons. And so when I realized how community-centric and common-centric crypto was. I was more looking at the speculative and you know, the criminal part.
Yeah, the outside face of it doesn't look particularly great, but like the actual.
So then the next step is, right, the next step is, you know, I gave my lecture there, I gave two lectures there, and there's some Chinese people, and they come to me and they're like, oh, wow, this is fantastic. I never heard this story before. And so it turned out to be the Global Chinese Commons, which is a Chinese crypto nomadic network, because crypto is mostly illegal in China. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, they become digital nomads so they can do their work and then go back to their families and not do anything illegal in China, basically. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, we're based in Chiang Mai. Wow. You know what? I have to go to Montenegro to meet people who have their headquarters in Chiang Mai. And so I'm doing research coordination for the GCC as well.
Oh, wow.
Nice. And so that's also helps me a lot to, you know, to become closer to the crypto world. Because, you know, I'm not a crypto person. I'm a person that tries to build bridges between domains, right? And so I'll know much less than you about crypto. Sure. But I will still know more than a lot of people who are skeptical or don't know anything about crypto. And I can make bridges between different domains because I had a kind of varied and rich life, which put me in, you know, many different spaces. You know, I've been in technology. I created two startups. I manage SMEs. I worked for two multinationals, you know, in strategy. I was a radical in my youth, and I was at the top of an international organization. I had a very intense spiritual search when I was young. So, you know, I've done the Eastern stuff. I've done alchemy, and so, you know, at some point, you know, you are able to draw from different worlds that normally don't speak to each other, right? But and that I can somehow translate more or less. So, you know, I'm not saying I know everything. You know, of course, that's not the case. But when you've been in a world, right, you understand it better than if you're just like reading from outside, right? You have to interact with the people, understand the culture from the inside. And so, you know, after a while, that gives you something that a lot of people don't have because
a broader perspective.
Probably for good reason, because they were not as unhappy as I was when I was young. So, you know, I just had to do it to search for like the solution, you know. And then at some point you discover you're just as fucked up as everybody else. and then it's
there's a lot of rabbit holes that I would have loved to, if we had more time to delve into there, right? Like particularly on the alchemy side of things, and you know, I guess that's very occult adjacent as well. And I find that.
Yeah, I've been a Templar, I've been a Mason, I've been a Rosicrucian. Wow. I wanted to know it all from the inside, and so I spent some years.
I think Ethereum is. I've been on the inside for Ethereum for basically the duration of its existence. In Bitcoin a little bit earlier than that. And it was almost like a quasi-religious experience for me in a way, because it was like the first time that I had found people who could actually hold different points of view in the mind and have an intelligent conversation and non-judgmental conversation
Different
ideas.
Yeah, that's so important. And so one of the things I learned from Zachary Stein, you know, he talks about invisible colleges, right? So when things are fragmenting and tribalizing and polarizing, and the people in the middle lose their influence. Like, you know, like Erasmus was very popular, but once they started with the Reformation wars, nobody listened to him because he, he didn't really choose a side, right? So what you then have are invisible colleges, which is smaller groups, right, are going to protect themselves to still be able to think and exchange, right? And that, by the way, was the role of the Masonic tradition. That was where Catholics and Reformation and atheists could talk together and different classes could come together without everybody else knowing that they were talking together. That's, you know, if you live in a highly repressive environment, that's what you need to do. And so I think, you know, that's to a certain degree we need to do this now, you know, because we have no guarantee that we'll have free speech left in 10 years or so.
That's why I work on the technologies that I do.
You know, Facebook, I quit Facebook because I couldn't even share like scientific peer-reviewed material, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane, that, you know, and... So I'm on Twitter. I think Twitter is more pluralistic, and it's not perfect, but it's more pluralistic. If you can't do it publicly, you have to do it in smaller groups.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the problem with crypto, you know, like the fragmentation, right? Which is like, you know, 500 Telegram groups for one thing, you know, and it's like, oh God, you know, well, can spend this day and night, and you still don't know, like only 5% of what's happening in a community.
Yeah. Like there's almost an interesting parallel with, say, you know, the establishment of the United States of America, and the Federalist Papers in particular, where you basically had a bunch of anons, you know, writing letters to each other. And, you know, regardless of the content, they were, you know, fearful of British rule, and rightly so for some reasons.
Right, of course.
And crypto is kind of doing the similar thing. You know, you have these anons that are, and other, you know, other political groups out there,
right,
being anonymous, publishing their information, like their ideas,
right, and censorship resistant, you know, zero knowledge proof. Yeah, I think, you know, that's necessary to protect these translocal groups.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, in the pursuit of truth,
and the transfer of value, I think, is very important, right? You like, if you don't have capital, you can't win, right? If you're living at the edges, you cannot invest in the expansion of your system, you will be marginal. So the capacity to transfer value, you know, is also a crucial aspect of crypto. And, you know, you talked about religion, right? And so that's also what I kind of discovered. And most people will be critical about it, but I think you need that, right? You need something that transcends your daily circumstance. And Viktor Frankl, in The Man in Search of Meaning, which, you know, he was in the concentration camps, right? He said only two kinds of people survived, the communists and the Catholics. The Catholics, because they have vertical transcendence and they could, you know, I'm going to heaven and, you know, okay. So they could kind of detach themselves. And the communists, because they had a temporal utopia, right, in the future. So I'm not saying both were right or wrong. What I'm saying is, like, the capacity to project yourself in the future is crucially important. And so what I'm doing, why I'm interested in cycles, is because the capacity, when you are in a declining phase, to go beyond the declining phase, right? To look at the next up cycle and to have sound ideas about what that next up cycle could look like, right? And so that's what I'm doing, is like analyzing seed forms.
Right.
And thinking, like, is that working? If it's working, what does it mean? And can we deduce from that, you know, like, characteristics of the future system that are emerging?
And so what are the different sort of scenarios that you foresee in the future, or, like, you think are likely, and, you know, can you pin them to any kind of cycle? I have
four worlds. You know, it's like a four-world theory, and there are four combinations of, so, centralizing global versus local and distributed. So they're not entirely the same, these two words, but, you know, I have only one quadrant, so I put them together. And then for profit and for benefit. So centralized for profit uses peer-to-peer and the commons in a fake way to extract from human cooperation. So that this is what I call netarchical capitalism. You know, the Googles and the Ubers. And I think there's a shift in capitalism from commodity-based capitalism. You know, I call it Marxist capitalism because there's an extraction of surplus value from human labor and nature to systems that directly exploit human cooperation. So they create platforms, we exchange and we work, and they tax us. So that we're back to rent, right? This is feudal. They're not profit makers in the sense that they make things that they sell a higher price. They tax us, right? Just as a serf had to give half of his produce to be able to use the land, right? So even capitalists today are exploited by them, because you have to give 30% of your profits in order to access the platforms, sometimes 70%. So then you have distributed capitalism, which is libertarianism. And so the idea is to make everybody in a small entrepreneur who can, you know, autonomously make agreements and create and share value. But it's still kind of for-profit oriented. Then you have urban commons, local, for-benefit oriented, and the global open source world, right? So these are four different systems, all based on peer-to-peer and in different combinations. They all exist and they all compete with each other. And then, of course, what is interesting is when you start having hybrids, right? Like crypto is evolving to incorporate open source, right? And what I want mm-hmm. is that crypto also incorporates the urban commons.
Right.
Because then we have...
I mean, that certainly exists within crypto. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're all, ReFi and all that, they're trying it. But what I'm critiquing is the lack of connection between all the people who in the cities are doing renewable energy co-ops and, collective access to organic food and real car sharing and cooperative housing and co-housing. And then they're not connected at all to the crypto world and vice versa. And I wrote something called Crypto for Real, where I call for, these alliances. This is what, that's my particular point of view, what I would like to see.
That would be really nice. Yeah, for sure. Those ideas were very prominent, even early on in Ethereum's life cycle. And Ethereum has a different sort of cultural affinity group around it than, say, the Bitcoiners do, right? Which is also quite interesting to note that, these different public programmable chains or public chains have their own sets of, behavioral characteristics, virtues and these sort of things. But I think, we're taking a long detour because there is a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built and ensuring things are scalable while maintaining the properties that we care about. And that's why you don't really see a very large decentralized application ecosystem. It exists, sure, but it's kind of in a almost like a halfway house, like a web 2.5 where you have...
Yeah, and the interfaces are often I use a wallet, but to be honest, I still find it very complex. And
yeah,
I often have to ask a friend, and we do screen sharing. Maybe it's my generational handicap, but I think it's way, way too complicated.
It is.
And, a lot of the publishing portals... Yeah, there's still a long way to go. But the thing is, it's been going on for 15 or 10 years. So the thing is, when Bitcoin goes down and the crypto goes down and you're still doing it, that's very important, right? Because that means that it's not just greed, it's not just speculation, you really believe in it. So that's where the religious aspect, it's an ideology also.
And yes, it really is.
We either have religion or we have ideology,
mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean it's true or false, but it's a way to make sense of the world, and it gives you need something transcendent, right? You need something that's beyond you, because if you just mm-hmm. follow your feelings, Monday you like it, Tuesday you hate it.
Yeah.
So if you want to be committed to something, you have to believe that it's more than that. You have to be willing to make sacrifices.
Yeah,
and I think
I'm no stranger to that.
Crypto has that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I believe it does, and I feel that for a large part of that, I'm an embodiment of it. And these sort of bear runs, I really appreciate for this. For the exact reason you mentioned, that the people who are here for the right reasons stay, right, and they continue building. And they also continue building almost on faith because, their runway or their, the faith amount of capital they margins. Have. Yeah. And I guess before we jump off, I was wondering, if there's any book recommendations you might have on some of these topics, particularly around cycles.
All right. Well, okay. You have Peter Turchin, Secular Cycles, mm-hmm. and he has a new book. I enjoyed Fourth Generation as well. Oh, mm-hmm. is it the Fourth Generation? I think so, right? That famous book about the generational cycle.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, the Fourth Turning. I'm sorry. It's the Fourth Turning.
There we go.
One book I really like is Kojin Karatani. It's called The Structure of World History, which is a really great summary of, many of these thinkers and doesn't really focus on cycles, but it's very good. So I have a section in my wiki called Civilization Analysis with very detailed overviews of all these authors. Mm-hmm. I have a site called a page called Sources of P2P Theory, where, you know, I survey all the things that influenced my thinking over the years. I have another one called What You Should Read About the Commons. And maybe in the description, I can send them to you and you can put it in the description. And so absolutely. People can.
Thank you very much.
So this is more than one book, but they, you know, they can choose which book that appeals most to them.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you for spending the time with us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, with pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation.